the outline of this today, this lecture is turning us toward the 20th century, toward modernism, away from the post-romantic. Although indeed the post-romantic, as I had occasion to say before, was a time of transition itself, with the conflicting streams of musical creativity and musical aesthetics between Germanic composers of Central Europe, their continuation of romantic values and priorities, and the rising nationalists surrounding Central Europe and indeed extending to North America, whose agendas were clearly different, and in by being different were challenging the primacy, challenging the supremacy of Germanic musical thinking. We know that the split between these two was manifest not simply in groups of composers, but even individual composers. It is far more reliable to identify a nationalistic composition than a nationalistic composer, because you have composers who are clearly, in certain genres, projecting their national cultural identity, and in other genres, far more universal, far more dramatic. An example, Edvard Grieg, Peer Gynt, a ballet score based on folk legends of Norway. The same Edvard Grieg composes a piano concerto that is unmistakably mainstream in its content and the subject matter. Piano concertos are not the context for nationalist expression as a rule. A ballet score quite obviously can. In addition, we find another, the beginnings of another break. One not so much concerned, shall we say, vertically with dramatic and nationalistic, but more horizontally in terms of generations of composers. And indeed, we see a significant divide between composers born before the decade of the 1860s, on the one hand, and composers born in the 1860s and thereafter. And you will know that I have, throughout the semester, talked about the virtues of organizing one's understanding of the history of music by thinking of composers and generations. To illustrate what I mean very quickly, Bach, Handel, and Domenico Scarlatti, 1685, C.P.E. Bach and Gluck, 1714, associated with the mid-18th century, the earliest classic style. 1732, Franz Josef Haydn. 1756, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. 1770, Ludwig van Beethoven. 1797, Franz Schubert, and the Gaetano Donizetti. 1810, Schumann and Chopin. You could throw in 1804, Fanny Hensel, 1807, Felix. 1811 Liszt, 1813 Verdi Wagner, 1833 Brahms. Those kind of succession of composers, and you can add your favorite ones in there. Smetana, 1841, for example, but whatever it is, excuse me, 1824, Dvorak, 1841. But in any case, when we get to the generation that's born in the 1860s, I think we can see at a glance that we have composers who are prophetic of a new approach to style. Let's look at the entire group. These are arranged not in alphabetical order, just quickly figured out in about a chronological order. Can you see that outline up in the cheat sheet, I think? We have Hugo Wolf, 1860. Died in 1903, but has lapsed, unfortunately, into irretrievable mental illness before then. We have Gustav Mahler, born the same year. He, too, dies comparatively young in 1911. Edward McDowell, American, but an American who, though not part of the Boston group, the Second New England School, is clearly a close ally, born in 1861. Corte de Sea, 1862. Again, like Mahler, progressive, forward-looking, we will see. Horatio Parker, one of the Boston group, student of John Knowles Paine and then Joseph Weinberger in Munich, 1863, 1919. Richard Strauss, again, 1864, forward-looking until the early teens, and then his style becomes, in some respects, more conservative. John Sibelius, 1865. Look how long he lives. But he's not composing in the last 30 years of his life. I think the longevity is due, since he was finished, to a combination of saunas and vodka. But that is yet fully deserved. 1867, Amy Beach. Amy Marcy Cheney Beach. Produced in 1944. By the Boston group. And in many respects, one of the most influential of the American composers, Scott Joplin, 1868. 1970. Now, you pick out of this group Mahler, Debussy, Joplin, you have composers who are prophetic of the future. Obviously, we don't identify all of this group as progressive. Wolf is the disciple of Richard Wagner. Wolf, in effect, wrote Wagner's art songs. As I believe I've had occasion to say in the commentary regarding Wolf on the court listing assignments, if Wagner was the opera specialist and the founder of a very influential style, Wolf was his disciple in the area of art song. Anton Bruckner was Wagner's disciple in the area of the symphony. And of course, the Boston group, Parker, Keith, under Ally McDowell, against probably the conservative tendency. As I said, Strauss began with the apparent intention of altering significantly, not revolutionizing the European tradition. But again, at the end of the first decade of the 20th century, his style becomes more conservative. He becomes a specialist. There are three major genres in which Strauss composed. He began with symphonic poems, with the Eulenspiegel, of course. He returned to opera, and opera was his major focus of concentration. The balance of his career, but running throughout his career, side by side with the tone poems and then opera, was art song. Also happens when he married a soprano.
We're playing in orchestra, that's a symphonic, that's a tone poem?
Yes.
Okay. It's
it was also included in the listening song. Now, Mahler's influence, and I will be turning to Mahler shortly if the audience suggests, may be traced most directly from Mahler to Arnold Schoenberg, from Arnold Schoenberg to his disciples. Alban Baird and Anton Weber. And from there to a number of other composers in the mid-20th century, both European and American. So Mahler to Schoenberg to Baird, Weber, and then post-World War II composers, both European and American. Scott Joplin, of course, from the African-American vernacular tradition. And he gave both to the United States and to Europe, particularly France, the influence of his many compositions in the new genre, the piano rag. A character piece, by some standards, not alone a march, American march, but also function. Ragtime, as I dedicated to mention before, became America's popular music from the 1890s to the end of World War I. Ragtime was one of the principal sources of the first style of jazz then associated with New Orleans. By some standards, New Orleans jazz in its most traditional form is ragtime for marching band, for dancing. Rags are also found to be influenced by ragtime, a sound in compositions by W.C., if you already know, another works Cakewalk. There's also another character piece that's not part of listening, obviously reflecting rag influence, Le Petit Nègre, Little Black. And Little Black, whom W.C. may be referring as a figure, I do not know if he came from Africa to France, France has some African colonies, remember that the colonies are where. But the French post-impressionist Henri de Toulouse Lautrec, which was a painting at one of the nightclubs in Montmartre where he hung out, it shows a diminutive African, Franco-African entertainment group. We also find its influence in the music of Charles Ives, no stranger to American vernacular. We also find Stravinsky sort of fumbling at it as well in one of his fellow disciplines. Any questions about this generation and the potential significance for art music and vernacular music? Gustav Mahler. We should speak of him first. Gustav Mahler was born in Bohemia. It was now the Czech Republic. He was Jewish. Which is to say, part of an ethnic group, culturally and by religion, isolated by many within Austro-Hungary. Anti-Semitism was a characteristic of belief, particularly in Vienna, the dog Mahler most of his life. Anti-Semitism, of course, seems to continue to be a Viennese fixation on the part of some, even to this day. Adolf Hitler resided in Vienna. Gustav Mahler's father was a teamster. And the word teamster did not apply to those who drive the big rigs, but their professional ancestors who drove freight wagons. Horse drawn freight wagons. His wife was the daughter of a soap man, Mahler's mother. In other words, we are talking about people of, by American standards, the working class. European terminology might refer to them as peasants. He was reared in an extremely dysfunctional family. And this he shares experience with Beethoven. His father was a wife beater, child beater, and was also, and this sort of goes with the baggage of abuse, sexually unfaithful to his wife. Maria Mahler bore 14 children. Of whom seven died under the age of two. One in his teens, and another by his own hand at the age of 21. It should not therefore be surprising that throughout much of Gustav Mahler's music are found both direct and indirect references to death. Those of you who heard the first symphony perform his first symphony will recall the incredibly powerful second movement, which is the slow movement. It is solo, bass, melody, and a minor key, composed shortly after the deaths, 2 months apart, of two of his younger brothers, one at the age of 16 months, the other at the age of 6 months. The implicit conflict of affect between the Bohemian folk dance, the polka, which I'm sure many of you at one time or another have done, whether you admit it to me or your peers today, and a funeral march, is suggestive of experiences that Mohler had throughout his life. A home steeped in tension, anxiety, and loss. And the outside world perceiving as if nothing was wrong. One could almost infer the dance was going on in the community. The funeral march was for the family itself. And again, we have that in that same slow movement of the first symphony. Because what contrasts with the funeral procession, the funeral melody, we read our mind in the minor key, a pleasant melody. With its upbeat or the upbeat dance music. Except the funeral march overwhelms it by the end. This kind of alienation from parents, a father who's a brute, a mother who is, of course, in many of the dysfunctional families, the mother is often absolutely helpless. Anybody, herself, children, from her husband. There's only one source of Mahler's profound psychological pain. His was a German-speaking family in a Czech-speaking province of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The German speakers were perceived to have power, and he was Jewish, and to be Jewish was to be outside of power. Catholics who surrounded him in Bohemia and the Czech Republic as a Catholic nation represented another source of alienation. We're reminded of that during a particular week. At sundown today begins the Jewish holiday, high holiday, Passover. And of course, Easter is next Sunday. In the 1880s, he managed to make his way to Vienna. And to make his way to the Vienna Conservatory. He made the acquaintance of Anton Bruckner. He was a good friend of Hugo Wolf, who was then also a student at the Conservatory. Notice the juxtaposition. Wolf and Mahler born in the same year, therefore meeting at the same age. Mahler was a person of enormous intellect, creativity. He composed music, conducted music, he wrote about music. He claimed that his philosophical and aesthetic mentors were four individuals, that his own sense of musical expression, its purposes, its content, were shaped by four individuals. Beethoven was becoming a large crowd, he said that Beethoven was a group. According to Mahler, it was Beethoven as the romantic. Beethoven who overcame the rigidities associated with the 18th century Enlightenment and restored music to its proper domain, the proper domain of music being feeling and emotion. This is one example of many of the situations in which we have Beethoven regarding himself as the heir to the 18th century, and later generations looking to Beethoven as the prophet of romanticism. Feeling and emotion. Beethoven restored that role to music. A philosopher named Arthur Schopenhauer, S-C-H-O-P-E-N, H-A-U-E-R, who argued that musical creation sprang from the subconscious. Interesting notion. Musical creation sprang from the subconscious. What's interesting about that is it presupposes that people are thinking, that there is an aspect of the human mind that is subconscious. That there are forces within our minds that we cannot be aware of, yet are very powerful in shaping our creativity. That is a 19th century concept. That, of course, points to the vision of the human personality that we associate with such path-breaking individuals as Sigmund Freud, another Viennese example. Wagner, of course, and particularly Wagner's principle of the Gesamtkunst family. The unification of the arts. Schopenhauer believed that Wagner's concept of the Gesamtkunst pair was how that subconscious that prompted musical expression was connected to nature. And Friedrich Nietzsche, N-I-E-T-Z-S-C-H-E, who in an essay called The Birth of Tragedy, anybody read that or some part thereof, argues that, and this will sound familiar, argued that there are two aspects to human existence, the rational and the emotional. The rational is represented by the Greek god Apollo. The emotional is represented by the Greek demigod Dionysus, the god of wine, and all that results from its excessive consumption. To Nietzsche, in The Birth of Tragedy, music provided the balance to all that rationality. It was Dionysiac, it was not Apollonia. Music is where the emotions were explored. The emotions that Beethoven had shown music to express, that Schopenhauer said came out of the subconscious, that Wagner demonstrated in his own music. Mahler believed that melodies proceeded from words. Heard that before? Yes. Gluck said that. Wagner said that. Mahler said that. Melodies proceed from words. Other elements proceed from words and from emotions, such as phonetic centers. When we think of Beethoven's key association, key structure of symphony, tonic, slow movement, sub-down, final two movements, tonic again. Compare that to Mahler's approach. In Mahler's second symphony, The Resurrection, it begins in C minor. It ends in E flat major. The standard relationship, right? C minor is the relative minor of E flat major. So Mahler, given the subject matter of the symphony, it took us from death to resurrection. C minor is death, E flat major is resurrection. The fourth symphony. From G major to E major. From birth to paradise. E major in this case being a round circle of fifths, not a vertical level, but X number of sharps above. Key relationships for Mahler have powerful philosophical implications. They address ideas. They address philosophical concepts, but not simply about harmony. philosophical significance, that is a legacy of thought. So, taking this all together, Gustav Mahler may be seen as a culmination of evolving philosophical and musical beliefs that cover the entire 19th century Germanic realm. I'm going to do that again. A culmination of philosophical beliefs and musical practice. Philosophical beliefs and musical practice that cover the entire 19th century Germanic cultural world. Any questions? Of course, in summer reading, I would encourage you all to read.
Being a Germanic composer, would he still be considered a post-Germanic and breaking out of the box, even though he's
from? Well, he's, the fact of the truth matters, he is not, in a sense, breaking out of the box.
When
opposed to the Germanic element of the post-Germanic represents the stream that goes forward into the 20th century. Now, it's the stream that undergoes all sorts of transformation.
Right.
But it's the stream when Mahler Schoenberg. As I was when I discussed Schoenberg, one of the points that's very important to understand about Arno Schoenberg is he believed very much in the fact that he was the heir to the Viennese tradition, going back to Beethoven, you know, before that,
but that it could change.
But in order to preserve it. Sense of a legacy that he was carrying forward, including knowledge. Okay. Other questions? Good question. Considering now the place of song, could be either C here, the place of song in Mahler's composition. Recall, I said, that he believed that music, melodies, proceeded from words. And it makes perfect sense that if that is an important fundamental value that shapes his musical expression, that the role of song, the role of vocal music, will play a prominent role in his composition, as indeed it does. Of 9 symphonies that he composed, and he was felt very ambivalent about going beyond 9 symphonies. He was the master of Beethoven, and only composed 9 symphonies. He did start at 10, but he died before it was finished. Of those 9 symphonies, 4 include vocal soloists. Numbers 2, 3, 4, and 8. One or more movements that are vocal solos, one or more movements. The 8th also uses several choirs. Not for nothing is the 8th symphony known as the Symphony of the Thousand. Indeed, its first performance in America, in New York, under the composer's direction, I believe, 900 plus performers. Orchestra, eight soloists, several choir, including children's choir, boys' choir. He also composed many art songs, me either. Beginning with these works in every instance, or almost every instance, as for voice and piano, in other words, program. But in many instances, subsequently orchestrating the accompaniment, so it became an orchestral art song, or concert performance, and was program. Song was a driving force in Mahler's music. Selection of texts that he set reflects his preoccupations, among which was the cat. Obviously, due to his childhood memories. One of his early collections of songs for the Amman's title, Kinder Toten Lieder. One word, Kinder, K-I-N-D-E-R. Toten, T-O-T-E-N. Lieder, L-I-E-D-E-R. Kinder Toten Lieder, songs on the deaths of children. Something with which Gustav Mahler had, of course, as a poet, which makes it serious. So listen to one. Mahler was an active conductor. He did his composing during summer when the orchestra that he presided over, the opera company, presided over the piano, was not active. Friedrich Bruegel, the poet, had lost his sons at the time. And he wrote more than 400 poems grieving their deaths. Gustav Mahler, in talking about this collection of four songs, told a friend, a scholar, like one of the founders of the discipline of musicology, and Guido Adler, quote, "I put myself in my thoughts into the situation of a man whose child had died." Mahler had children who did not die, but it was no stranger to the death of children, as I quote. There are, in this song, several elements that I want you to be mindful of as you listen to, referred to before. It is the full orchestra, very full orchestra, but you will not get that impression from what you hear because of one distinctive trait of Mahler's approach to orchestration of music. Except for climactic episodes for which the full orchestra is called upon, as indeed you saw at the end of the First Symphony of his first symphony when being the horn call standing up and playing. Much of the passages, and many of the passages in his compositions for orchestra and voice, have the character of chamber music. Only a few instruments out of that enormous ensemble are in fact actively performing. You will notice he's very careful about the structure of the song. There will be a clear interlude separating the two strings. And I want you to pay special attention to the final line. But let's consider the text for a moment. Nun will die Sonne zur Hölle aufgehen, aus sei kein Unglück, die Nacht gesehen. Das Unglück geschah, nur wir allein, die Sonne, sie scheint, allein. Du musst nicht die Nacht in dir verschwenden, musst sie in Ether wissen. Versenken. Ein Lettlein der Losch in meinem Zeit, als sei die Kultus als der Welt. Now will the sun so brightly rise again as if no misfortune occurred in the night. The misfortune happened to me alone. The sun shines for everyone. You must not become tangled up with the night of yourself. You must be immersed in perennial life, a little lamp out in my tent, blessed in the joyous life of the world. What incredible contradictions embedded in us two stanzas. Something happens in the night. The sun is rising. The light is for everybody. I'm the only one of you to whom this thing happened in the night. And of course, you may presume what happened in the night as a child. But even so, even though that happened, don't let it bother you. You must be immersed in that perennial somewhere. Only in my tent will the light go. Blessed be the joyous life of the world. As you listen to that and follow the text, I want you to note very carefully the difference between the words themselves, the plain sentence, and how Mahler sets them, and the effect of the setting, especially this final one. Heil's idea came from this type of the blessed be the joyous life.
Thank you.
This is an improved example of using irony. Irony, of course, means expressing a sentiment in such a way, mode of expression undermines and would point to joyous, joyousness. Same.